Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 9th of July. It is all things political, and we're going to concentrate on the economy and the jobs numbers released on Friday. And the second part of the hour, we're going to be concentrating on the Senate race in the state of Wisconsin. The jobs numbers, in case you missed them, were released on Friday, and it's not a very pretty picture. According to the Labor Department's survey of firms' payrolls, the economy created only 80,000 jobs in June, which means that things are going downhill. Between January and March, it created 226,000 jobs each month. Between April and June, the rate of job growth fell by almost two-thirds to an average of 75,000 jobs a month. The unemployment rate, this stayed steady in June at 8.2%. And between last summer and April of this year, the unemployment rate fell a full percentage point from 9.1% to 8.1%, but it has stayed pretty consistent. We'll talk about the number of Americans looking for work. We'll talk about whether or not overregulation and Obamacare are causing companies not to hire new workers. As you heard during the news, the president is calling for a one-year extension of the Bush-era tax cuts for those who are making under $250,000 a year. So there's a lot on the economic front, and we're going to concentrate on that this first part of All Things Political. Here's our phone number for you to join the conversation. The first half hour with David Wessel, economics editor for The Wall Street Journal. Later with Cameron Joseph, who is a staff writer at The Hill. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. And you can always leave a message on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. David Wessel, economics editor of The Wall Street Journal and author of the forthcoming Red Ink, Inside the High Stakes Politics of the Federal Budget, is our first guest. Hello, David. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about the job numbers to begin with. What happened? Why did the rate of job growth fall by almost two-thirds?
Well, what we saw this year was a fairly strong hiring pattern in the first 3 months of the year, and then three months, April, May, and June, a very sluggish job growth. We are adding jobs. We're just adding them at a painfully slow rate. There's two possibilities. Well, there's 100 possibilities, but at least two possibilities. One is that it's kind of a seasonal fluke. We had warmer than usual weather, and maybe some of the hiring that usually happens in the spring was done earlier and so forth. And that would be very comforting. That would suggest that when you even it all out, things are okay. I think there's probably a little bit to that, but unfortunately, that's not the biggest part of the story. The second part of the story is that employers, like a lot of investors and some consumers and workers, have in the back of their mind how bad things really got in 2008 and 2009. And particularly with all this turmoil in Europe, which is going into recession, and reports of slowing economies everywhere from Brazil to China, if a whole lot of employers get cautious all at the same time, then you see this slowdown in hiring. And it's this anticipation that things are going to get worse rather than better that, in my opinion, is accounting for this very disappointing report.
Are there certain sectors of the economy that are hiring nicely?
Well, throughout the last couple of years, we've seen fairly strong demand in healthcare. They're not surprising. As we spend more and more on healthcare, there's more hiring there. And we've seen for what you might call personal service jobs, trainers, home health aides, manicurists, hairdressers, those jobs that can't be automated and can't be outsourced, that hiring has been relatively strong. One of the things that's happened very recently is that manufacturing had been adding jobs, and that's kind of slowed a bit, and that's disturbing. At the same time, construction, which has been awful in hiring, has actually begun to pick up just a little bit, and that's encouraging.
Mm-hmm. You have written recently about health spending. Can we spend just a minute on that and how much the Affordable Care Act has changed the health care market, even though we don't have a full implementation of the law yet?
Well, before the president's Affordable Care Act was approved by Congress, there was a noticeable slowing in the pace of growth in health care spending. That's not to say it went down. It just grew at a slower rate. During the recession, a whole lot of people stop going to the doctor as often, put off elective surgery, and we saw a decline in the amount of health care that people, that some people wanted. And that coupled with some changes in the way hospitals and doctors were behaving. The big question is that all temporary, and once the economy recovers, as it surely will someday, will we go back to the very strong rates of growth in healthcare spending, or is something fundamental changing in the way doctors and hospitals, insurance companies organize themselves? Those people who are most invested in the president's healthcare plan working, I see all sorts of little signs, and they say, aha, in anticipation of the Affordable Care Act and all the things that we put in there, hospitals and doctors are beginning to practice differently. And the people who are less convinced of that say, oh, but it's all the recession, and there's not a lot of evidence that there are things that are changing enough to make people behave differently. It's an incredibly important question. It's unfortunately one we don't have the answer to. One quarter of all federal spending goes to health care now.
Wow.
And it's on the track to hit one-third by a decade from now. So that's just one example of why just the rate of increase in healthcare spending is a huge factor in everything from the federal budget to whether employers can afford to give raises and so forth.
Now, there was a note of optimism in what you just said. When the economy gets better, and it will, what does it take for it to get better?
The economy is getting better. It's a little bit like a patient who had a heart attack. We're out of intensive care. We don't appear to be at risk of repeating the Great Depression, but we are not healthy yet. And it is extraordinary how long this is taking. The idea that the economy has been expanding since the middle of 2009 and we still have 8.2% unemployment. We still have something like 3.75 million people who have been out of work for a full year, and these are the ones who say they're still looking. The idea that the Federal Reserve cut interest rates to zero at the end of 2008, and they are still at zero 4 years later, and the Fed says they're going to keep them there for another 2 years. So it's hard to exaggerate what an extraordinary period in economic history this is.
Mm-hmm.
The problem we have now is that the pace of improvement is so slow that it'll be 3 or 4 years before we're back to anything like full employment. So I don't think America's dead and that our economy is never going to recover. But the question is, will this very slow pace, create lots of social problems, like people who never get back to work and go on disability, whatever, and B, leave us vulnerable to being sliding back into recession if we have a spate of bad news, whether it's oil prices going up or the Europeans screwing up the world economy. What it'll take is for more people to be working. That's the one thing we need. More people working means more consumer spending, which means they buy more. It means it's easier for them to pay their debts. And that's the thing that, as we pointed out at the beginning of this conversation, has been lacking.
Mm-hmm. Plus, they feel better, right?
Yeah.
It's good to have a job. I'd like for you to respond to Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, who was on CNN's State of the Nation yesterday. And this is what he had to say about why people are not hiring.
Things like Obamacare, things like overregulation are causing companies not to hire. And we've got the fiscal cliff coming at the end of the year. You know, what we ought to be doing is extend the current tax rates for another year with a hard requirement to get through comprehensive tax reform one more time. I negotiated with Vice President Biden the 2-year extension of the current tax rates that we're in right now. The president signed it because he argued that to let taxes go up would make the economy worse. We have a slower growth rate today than we had then. That would settle at least part of the problem.
Let's start with the second first, because we heard news today that the president is calling for a 1-year extension for tax cuts for those who are making $250 and under. McConnell is calling for something different, suggesting a different kind of extension for everybody and extend them permanently, I believe. Or he is saying that maybe there could be a mini compromise in the form of another temporary extension. Are the Republicans calling for extension for everybody, or would they agree with the president that maybe we should do a tax cut for those under $250,000? And is this a good thing or a bad thing?
The president is going to repeat what he's been saying all along, that he wants to let the Bush tax cuts, which he has extended repeatedly, expire, but only for those people making over $250,000 a year. And the Republicans say, no, we don't want them to expire for anybody.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, the Congress and the president agreed to put a gun to their head, and they said, if we don't come up with some compromise on the deficit by the end of this year, we're going to have across-the-board spending cuts, which are going to hit particularly hard in defense, and taxes are going to go up, both the payroll tax holiday that we've enjoyed for the past couple of years and income tax rates will go up. And what's happening now is two things. One, they're a little nervous about anything that would increase taxes at the end of this year when the economy appears to be so weak. They had hoped it would be stronger. And B, they're worried that they won't be able to do this grand compromise on the deficit, so they're all saying, well, we're going to kick the can down the road a little longer. Almost everything you hear from Senator McConnell or President Obama or Mitt Romney right now is complete posturing for the political campaign. That's inevitable. That's the way it is. And it may not give us very much information about what they would do after the elections. But there's a backdrop to this, which is, can we do something about our deficit without raising taxes? And President Obama says no, and the Republicans say yes, but that would require much deeper spending cuts than it appears to me the American people will live with. Nobody thinks it's a great idea to raise taxes when the economy is weak, but there are lots of ways you could do something that would firmly put into law a different tax system that might have higher tax revenues, that might have tax reform with lower rates and fewer deductions, and say this will take effect only when the economy recovers. There's never a good time to raise taxes. It's not smart to raise taxes when the economy's weak, but it's also not smart to say we're not going to deal with our deficit until we have a crisis, because then we'll have many fewer choices.
The other thing that I have heard for a long time now is this excessive government regulations. McConnell mentioned those in his comments yesterday, which is keeping companies from hiring. And also this fear, particularly among those in small businesses in this country, that health care reform is going to hurt them hard, thus they can't plan on adding new employees.
The major reason companies aren't hiring, in my opinion, is they're not sure that the demand for their products and services is going to be there. And that goes back to the beginning of our conversation about how slow growth was. If you thought you could sell the cars or the insurance or whatever it is that you make, or the newspapers or the radio sets, you know, somehow all this worry about regulation and uncertainty seems kind of insignificant. So I think the major uncertainty is, will the demand be there? There is no doubt that when you have a lot of uncertainty about everything from healthcare costs to taxes to regulation, it has to make people less likely to hire than they would otherwise. Whether it's as much a factor as the Republicans say is very hard to determine. I mean, how do you know why someone doesn't hire? People don't actually write down it's 20% uncertainty about regulation and so forth. It is true that there is an unusual amount of uncertainty now. But sometimes I kind of get amused when business people say that, and you say to them, okay, here's the deal. The president's health care plan is going into effect. The Supreme Court has approved it. What if they did a deal on taxes and that was certain, but it would involve you paying more in taxes? Then you discover, well, they're not actually always so interested in certainty as they are in winning their argument. So I think it's a little bit overplayed. It's definitely a factor, but it's overplayed.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Here's our number. We have a couple of people on the line at the moment. The number is 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. And this is All Things Political. Our guest, the first part of the program, David Wessel, economics editor of the Wall Street Journal, author of the book coming out soon, Red Ink, Inside the High Stakes Politics of the Federal Budget. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to some of your phone calls, starting with Willem in Colfax. Hi, Willem.
Hi, good morning. I remember before the recall election in the state of Wisconsin.
Can you speak up a little? You're kind of far from. There you go.
Before the recall election in Wisconsin, Governor Scott Walker was talking quite a bit about how this uncertainty is what was causing the job creators to not create jobs in Wisconsin because there was all this uncertainty. And since the uncertainty has been removed, still doesn't seem to be a lot of activity by the, you know, the so-called job creators. And when I've asked, like Senator Ron Johnson or other politicians, my state senator Terry Moulton, I've asked them for specific regulations that are inhibiting job growth, and they never come up with any. They just it seems to be a generic term, and I was wondering what these regulations, or if he might have any ideas of what specific regulations are causing the problem.
Well, first of all, you could fit in a thimble what I know about Wisconsin, so I'm not going to be able to shed much light to what's going on there, although I would say that what goes on in any one state in terms of hiring has a lot to do with national and international forces as well as local ones, particularly for businesses that sell to customers all over the world. The people who say that regulation is a problem point to, among other things, the more aggressive enforcement of regulations, OSHA, EPA, National Labor Relations Board, Security and Exchange Commission, a whole host of regulations that have been on the books for a long time. And I don't think there's any doubt that in the Bush presidency, the enforcement was less aggressive than it is in the Obama presidency. That's not a political point. That's an observation of the different attitude towards enforcement. Secondly, as the host mentioned earlier, you know, this healthcare bill is very complicated. And you hear a lot of people saying, if I have 49 people, I'm going to have to do this. And if I have 51 people on my staff, I'm going to have to provide them health insurance. Why would I want to let my company grow to be 51 employees? And we know that that kind of behavior happens. It happens whenever you set any kind of a threshold. I think there are a lot of employers who are under misimpressions about what the Obama health care plan would be to them. But we know it's hard to see how that would be encouraging anybody to hire. I think the issue is how big of a negative factor is it, and I want to repeat what I said earlier. If the businesses thought they could sell the stuff, I think they would be hiring.
Let's talk about public sector for a moment. In a piece in the Wall Street Journal, it says this, as the private sector expands cautiously, the public sector is cutting back. Government payrolls declined by 4,000 jobs in June. They have fallen in all but 3 months in the past 2 years. At the local level, layoffs of teachers, postal workers, and other public employees continue to drag down the pace of overall job growth.
Right. So that's, I think, one of the big differences between Barack Obama and Mitt Romney right now. Barack Obama's line is, it's dumb for the federal government to stand by and let state and local employers, state and local governments, who employ many more people than the federal government, lay people off because they don't have the money. That the federal government should essentially be borrowing more now, giving more aid to the state and local governments so they will lay off fewer people. It's what the president proposed in this thing he called the American Jobs Act. And to the extent that he's specific, Mitt Romney, the Republican, has said he thinks that it's more important for the government to get out of the way and let the private sector do more hiring, and he seems less concerned with these layoffs at the state and local level. It is definitely true, when you look at the numbers for the last month, that government employment has fallen and private sector employment has gone up. So we know what why we only created 80,000 jobs is we didn't create more private sector jobs than we cut public sector jobs.
Right. And there was, is this conversation over? There was conversation, as you well know, not that long ago, that we need to stimulate the economy and maybe adding some construction jobs, fixing bridges, infrastructure jobs, hiring more teachers might be a good thing for the government to do to spark the economy. Is that conversation ended?
Well, I think it's on hold until after the election.
Look,
there's good reason to both sides have strong feelings about this. The people who are in favor of stimulus say that the only problem with the stimulus was it wasn't big enough. And the people who are skeptical about it said there's a limit to how much money you can pump into the economy and get the results, and we've reached that limit. I think that the president has tried to make the case that there are things that we could spend money on now that would put people to work and would benefit us in the future. That's basically the argument for infrastructure. Larry Summers, the former Treasury Secretary, has made a very strong case that with interest rates so low, the government ought to borrow now and do all the infrastructure it wants to do over the next 30 years and do it all in the next 5 years just to get people back to work. But the people on the other side say, look, you know, there's a bottleneck here, and you keep pouring money into this stuff, and we'll end up with more projects that sound appealing but actually won't do much good, and it's just a waste of money. And they're worried about the amount of debt that we're taking on if we do more of that. At the moment, that conversation has been fought to a draw. Congress isn't going to do anything on this now. I can imagine, more likely if Obama wins than Romney wins in November, and Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke has talked about this, some kind of two-fisted fiscal policy where you might do some spending in the short term, but it would be packaged with some commitment and really binding, not just kind of promises and targets, to cut spending on things like benefits in the long term in order to get deal with the deficit and the short-term problem at the same time.
Jim in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi. I'd like to state a working outline for a moral case for regulation. And I would stress that people got to put this on paper and network it both in and out of state. And the first thing that I'd suggest that people do as they're listening to this is to put on the computer and call up Robert Hare, H-A-R-E, psychopathy checklist. Psychopaths constitute 4% of the population, which is over 12 million people, and they're characterized by no remorse and no empathy, and they pose a serious threat to us. Now, regulation inherently, or deregulation, is crazy. In some cases, we know from the deregulated intersection where you could enter any time, any speed, any direction, drunk or sober. But it goes much further than that. Milton Friedman makes the argument that corporate profits are the only for the shareholder are the only thing, and that this anything else is immoral. But this this externalizing and neglecting the impact on people ignores the fact that we're supposed to love our neighbors ourselves. We're not supposed to worship false gods, which would include making unlimited money at any cost. And if the concept of do no harm for doctors applies, why doesn't it harm apply to all of us in the exercise of our vocations? And I think it comes down to a core issue to ask the question, do we really trust people as a whole to operate without regulation? Well, we can't trust the psychopaths in the first place. Secondly, we can't trust everybody all the time because we're all fallible human beings subject to error. We can't trust people who are under pressure to keep their jobs to be whistleblowers in all cases. And we can't trust the people to the extent that people are desperate to be working, and so sometimes people will sell out, and so we have situations like the people, the scientists that supported cigarette smoking who were working for the tobacco companies. So I think the core issue is we have to have regulation because we cannot trust people in all circumstances to do the right and honorable thing.
Thank you, Jim, for the call. I always feel like if you missed your service yesterday, we get it with Jim on Monday mornings, which it's always a welcome call. David.
All right. So we know that markets are probably the best way to organize economic activity, and we know that markets need adult supervision, that you can have too little regulation and you can have too much regulation. There are some, but very few people that argue that we ought to have no regulation. All the important questions are in the middle. What kind of regulation and how much is too much? And that's basically where the rational debate comes from. It's not what you hear in the political slogans, but it's where the rational debate comes from. For instance, the National Labor Relations Board gave Boeing a hard time for moving a factory from Washington State to, I think it was, South Carolina, and they were clearly doing it to avoid the union. Is that something that the government should try and stop, or is that sort of letting the market work? How much should the government try and limit what banks do, because we've seen how much damage banks can do when they are unregulated or not regulated enough, but how much is so much that the banks won't be willing to make loans because it's safer not to make the loan than to make it? We have arguments about how fast, what should the speed limit be? Should it be 50 miles an hour or 70 miles an hour? I think that there's a sense that we ought to think about the costs and the benefits of regulation, and that there are costs to regulation. It's just that the weighing of those costs and benefits is very difficult and sometimes inherently political and sometimes, as the caller suggests, even moral.
Yeah. Do you want to just comment? There's so much for us to talk about here. It's like, but you were talking about regulation of banks. Can you make a brief comment on the UK-based bank Barclays and what's going on with why it was less than truthful in reporting interest rates that it was just paying to borrow from other banks? Is this a big story?
I think it is a big story, and it's a big story for at least two reasons. One is, so what happens is a bunch of banks, about a dozen and a half banks, all report how much they're paying to borrow money from other banks. And this isn't just information that goes on the Internet the way the temperature goes on the Internet. It becomes a benchmark for financial markets and regulators and central banks to gauge how much stress there is in the financial market. So if they were getting a faulty reading because the banks were afraid to say how much they were really costing them to borrow, or because they were manipulating the rate because they had traded on expecting one thing and they wanted to make money, then a whole lot of the gauges that were used during the financial crisis were off. So that's the first thing. Bad information could lead to bad decisions, and maybe things were worse than we knew in 2008. Maybe governments would have done something even more aggressive if they'd done it. The second thing is, and this actually goes to the point of the caller earlier, we are building a stockpile of reasons not to trust markets and not to trust bankers, and this is just one more outrageous case. I mean, you have a ridiculous situation where a whole bunch of banks organized in a bankers association are supposed to be truthful, and they have every incentive not to be truthful, and now we see from the documents that have been disclosed in the Barclays case they weren't truthful. So that makes it really hard to say we ought to let the banks loose a little more. It's one more reason that we'll have tighter bank regulation, whether you like it or not.
Mm-hmm. And finally, we got to do a political question during our All Things Political, talking about whether or not this jobs number really works to the benefit of Mitt Romney, who people feel can handle the economy a little better. The second part of this is how the president seems to be really on Mitt Romney these days with Bain Capital, with his Swiss bank account, the Grand Cayman funds, et cetera. Why is the president going that direction politically, and is Mitt Romney the clear winner when we have bad jobs numbers?
Look, jobs are a big factor in the election because they're a big factor in people's lives. The president can argue that things would have been worse if not for me, but that's not a very good bumper sticker. So the president would like to discuss almost anything but jobs. Today it's taxes, or it's attacking Bain Capital and Mitt Romney's past record in Massachusetts or whatever. And Mitt Romney thinks that it doesn't matter so much whether I have a coherent plan to create jobs. All I have to do is capitalize on people's unhappiness with the performance of the economy. When people are unhappy about the economy, they usually vote for change. Barack Obama benefited from that impulse to change the last time around. It's really hard to run as the candidate of change when you're when you've been president for 4 years. So Romney's trying to pick up on that. I think it's unambiguous. The worse the economy is, the worse the job numbers, the easier it is for Mitt Romney and the worse it is for Barack Obama. Doesn't mean that Romney's going to win, but this is a headwind that the president is facing, and you could hear the deep sigh of disappointment from the White House when the numbers came out on Friday.
Right. Thank you, David, so much.
You're welcome.
Could talk for hours. There's so much in the news. Thanks. David Wessel, please join us again. Economics editor of the Wall Street Journal. He's author of the book, and we'll definitely book him when the book comes out, Red Ink, Inside the High Stakes Politics of the Federal Budget. Switching focus to what's going on in the state of Wisconsin, as you probably are aware, or maybe you've tuned out of politics because we have been in a constant election cycle, but there is a race for the U.S. Senate, and there's a primary coming up on August 14 for the Republicans. So how tuned in are we to this race? What's interesting about it is that at the recent Republican state convention, Tommy Thompson finished fourth in the endorsement vote, but polls are showing that Tommy Thompson could win this race against Democrat Tammy Baldwin. So we're going to be looking at why this disparity between what those gathered at the convention thought would be the best way to go and what polls are saying could be winnable for the Republicans. This part of the program, Cameron Joseph is going to be joining us, staff writer at The Hill. He's been following Wisconsin as well as some other Senate races in the country, so we can talk about a few of the other races as well. But let's start, of course, with Wisconsin. Welcoming phone calls as well, as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@WPR.org, and the Facebook page is The Kathleen Dent Show. Hello, Cameron Joseph. Thanks very much for being with us. Whoops, I'm sorry. I put the wrong microphone on. Hello, Cameron.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Hi, yeah, thanks very much for being with us. You know, maybe it's just because we have been in recall election television ads and we're exhausted by this, but I don't think that the state of Wisconsin is fully focused on this race yet.
No, I think that's incredibly accurate. I think that basically people know who Tommy Thompson is. They have kind of some warm, fuzzy past feelings about him, but no one has a strong opinion. Most of the other candidates are relatively unknown. And I think a lot of folks are very exhausted from what has basically been 18 months of constant campaigning. And just the hardcore activists might be starting to tune in to this primary, which is coming up in early August. But I think it's going to be a pretty low turnout election. I think that that could be a little risky for Tommy Thompson because of the way this is playing out. But this is just, you know, after everything that's happened in the state and then the upcoming presidential race, I just don't see this race as important as it is getting that much oxygen in the state.
Mm-hmm. I guess I have to ask a question. How could he not win when you look at polls that show that he could beat the Democratic challenger, well, the Democrat here, Tammy Baldwin, by really large percentage points? Wouldn't the Republicans naturally rally around him?
Well, I think he was making that argument to me that he's the strongest general election candidate. I don't think there's any doubt that he would be the strongest general election candidate. If he was the nominee, I think that he would start off with a pretty clear advantage over Tammy Baldwin. The other candidates, I think it would probably start out as toss-up or even a slight edge to Baldwin. But GOP primary voters, especially the really hardcore activists, especially as polarized as the state has become this day and the nation as well, it's just unlikely. It's difficult for Thompson with some of his past voting records to explain away, you know, why he supported the individual mandate for health care, things like that, which they have him on video saying in 2006. Again, in 2008, he made comments similar to that. So there's a lot of ammunition for the folks who are going to be attacking Thompson. The question is whether the pro-Thompson forces, which it looks like, you know, it's about a third of the Republican electorate, is going to vote for him no matter what. If that's enough with a split field when you're looking at a couple other candidates, former Congressman Newman, businessman Eric Hovde, and then Jeff Fitzgerald, who's a very close ally of Walker's, although he doesn't have that much money in this race. And they all seem to be splitting up the anti-Thompson vote pretty equally. So it's going to be interesting to see how that plays. But I really think that it's very little about electability and very much about ideology when you're talking about a Republican primary election like this.
Isn't it difficult to be a Republican these days? If you have a past voting record, you felt strongly about an issue in the past and you formulated your response accordingly and you carried on with it. It must make it hard for people to just be honest about who they are.
I think that's true. And talking to Tommy Thompson, he was, you know, very, very much running away from a few of the things that he backed in the past. I sat down with him, I guess it was about 2.5 weeks ago, and you know, I asked him about Medicare Part D, which, you know, he was Health and Human Services Secretary under President George W. Bush, and was really instrumental in that. From reports I saw, he was, you know, standing right outside the Senate floor, are you lobbying for senators to back it at the last minute? And I asked him about it, and he basically, you know, it was completely unfunded, added a lot to the deficit. And he was basically saying, look, this is, you know, a good thing. It cost less than they were predicting at the time, but I would have paid for it. You know, my job wasn't to figure out how to pay for it. My job was to work for the president, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, he's starting to take some of these softer stances, backing away from his previous stances. His campaign screams bloody murder every time you mention the fact that he has supported the individual mandate in the past. Some of his opponents have been arguing that he backed Obamacare, as they like to call it, which isn't really true. He backed, he was backing a bipartisan compromise early on, eventually came out against the president's plan before it was passed. But he's got some real vulnerabilities on that issue, as well as the fact that he expanded public employee pensions in the state. He worked fairly closely with some of the public employee unions that were really antagonistic with Scott Walker and pushed this recall. And so there's a lot of fodder there. The question is, you know, how heavily the Club for Growth, this D.C. group, comes in and spends against him. And they've suggested they're going to be spending very heavily. And how much traction Eric Hovde can get versus Mark Newman. Hovde has already been spending, I think he's upwards of $3.5 million on his own ads.
Goodness.
Now. So he's really, you know, he's kind of, we saw in 2010 a very expensive Senate race where a big spending Republican spent his way through the Senate primary and then won the general. Hovde's trying to copy that mold. So it'll be interesting to see how well he does. Mark Newman is, you know, very popular with some conservatives, but he and the governor had a very contentious primary that I don't think the wounds have fully healed. A lot of Scott Walker's supporters are still not in love with him because of how negative that got. So it's a really convoluted and complex primary, and it's going to be a very low turnout primary, so it's very difficult to predict how this is going to break.
Yeah. Why doesn't Fitzgerald have a lot of money here?
Well, I think basically he's just unfortunately being squeezed to the sidelines a little bit. I mean, part of it's his own campaign, but a lot of it is just, you know, when you have somebody like Tommy Thompson, who has almost universal name recognition in the state, when you have Mark Newman, who the D.C. conservative groups have been rallying around, when you have Hovde, who can spend all of his own money on this race, and Fitzgerald is, you know, a fairly little-known candidate. I mean, he's known by some of the hardcore activists who are very involved with the Scott Walker recall election because he was very active in that. But Walker has not come out. You know, Walker said, I'm staying out of this. I'm going to play referee. And really, you know, while he praises Fitzgerald, he hasn't been, you know, fully behind him.
Mm-hmm.
And even if Walker's kind of quietly behind the scenes working for him, which I haven't really seen any strong evidence of, you know, Fitzgerald just is the odd man out, I think. He's the only guy who doesn't have the resources to buy name recognition or starting off with a built-in name recognition. He's only known in certain parts of the state and in certain circles. And it's going to be very hard for him, even though he's been polling, you know, in double digits. There's a bunch of polls that showed him up around 20% in February, March, and all of a sudden in the last poll from Marquette University in mid-June, he was back down to about 10% and in fourth place. So my guess, I mean, he really has very little money, and I just don't see how he's going to get much traction. And really, I think he's going to play more of a spoiler role in this race than actually be a competitor.
What D.C. conservative groups are behind Mark Newman? How much money do they have? How influential are they, and why are they behind Mark Newman?
Well, the Club for Growth is the biggest player in that, and they are a very fiscally conservative group, pretty uncompromising. They're very powerful. They can spend probably, you know, $3 to $4 million on this race if they want. Mark Newman and the group's head, former Congressman Chicola, even though they didn't overlap in the House, have developed a pretty good relationship. Also, a few of Newman's former staffers from when he was in the House are now at the Club for Growth. And so Tommy Thompson's criticized them for that, saying that, you know, this is kind of them just helping their buddy. But Newman is, you know, very fiscally conservative. He was talking about the deficit back as early as, you know, when he was in Congress in the early 1990s. And his long push that issue is, you know, very against raising taxes. Has long been kind of in this Tea Party mold that the Club for Growth tends to back, especially, you know, on the fiscal issues. And they can really, really make a lot of noise. Jim DeMint is also backing, senator from South Carolina, is also backing Newman. His group, the Senate Conservatives Fund, just switched from a normal PAC to a super PAC. It's unclear how much they'll be able to spend, but in some other races they've spent upwards of, you know, $1 to $2 million. So when you start looking at those different groups and how that's going to play, you know, they could definitely spend Newman into being competitive. And the question really I have is how hard they focus on attacking Tommy Thompson. You know, in Indiana when they beat Dick Lugar, who's the longest-serving senator on the Republican side, you know, they were very instrumental in that race, and they really, because it was a one-on-one race between Lugar and Murdoch, they were really able just to spend against Lugar and just run attack ad after attack ad. But because of Hovde, it's kind of a complicated field right now, where Hovde's also going to be attacking. He's got his own money. He's buying his own name recognition, and it's really a question of how much they're willing to attack him, how they split the resources, how much they do on pro-Newman advertising, because Newman has a decent amount of money, but not really enough to necessarily be able to carry himself completely without outside group help. So it's going to be a very complicated thing. They're going to have to make some difficult decisions in terms of how they target their ads, how many positive versus negative ads they run, and how that really frames up. So it's going to be interesting to see, and I was actually going to call them later today to find out, you know, just talk through with them how they're planning on doing that. But they've told me that they're not just going to attack Thompson, that they're also going to go after Hovde, and that, you know, if they need to run pro-Newman ads, they will. So it's going to, I think that could be the biggest X factor, is how the Club for Growth and the Senate Conservatives Fund end up playing in this race.
And there are many who say that Tammy Baldwin, these polls could be way off, is a formidable candidate. She's been around for a long time and is pretty well known in this state and is a superb campaigner. So let's mention that, too, and talk a little bit about her. We welcome phone calls this half hour of the show. Cameron Joseph, staff writer at The Hill, is our guest, and he's been following the Wisconsin Senate race pretty closely. Are you following it closely, or have you had it with politics? If you've had it, you're not listening to us this half hour. But I'm interested in hearing your analysis of what's going on with this pretty significant race, and it's coming up quite soon, August 14. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org, or leave a message on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dent Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program today, all of you physicists in the audience, please call and explain fully your understanding of this scientific breakthrough, which took place last week. And scientists are saying it confirms our understanding of how the universe works. It's called the Higgs boson particle, and some say that it could be one of the greatest achievements in science. We will talk about that hour two of our show. This half hour, Cameron Joseph, staff writer at The Hill, is with us. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Although polls have shown that Tommy Thompson could beat Democrat Tammy Baldwin, there are other polls saying that this could be a very close race. She is, I don't think it's an understatement to say, she's a formidable opponent.
Yeah, she's run a very good campaign so far. I mean, she's got a very liberal track record, which could hurt her in certain parts of the state. You know, she's advocated for a long time for a government-run single-payer health insurance system, which they have plenty of, you know, the GOP has plenty of video on. They've already started running against her. But, you know, she's got a very strong personal story. She's a very, very good, campaigner. She's really good at the handshaking part of the campaign. She's, you know, very clearly a Wisconsinite. Yeah, she sounds like she's from the state. She's grew up around Madison, Dane County, and really, you know, she doesn't seem like an outsider. You know, people are going to try and tar her as a Madison liberal, which may or may not, there's an element of truth to that, but I mean, she comes off as very folksy. She's a very strong campaigner. But, you know, the polls show that Thompson is leading her by a pretty good margin. And really, I think the question is, you know, when this shakes out, I mean, Thompson is very well liked in the state. Even if they're both personally well liked, you know, Thompson is not seen as this really far right guy. And I think he's going to be able to win a lot of independents and run more than a few points ahead of Mitt Romney in the state. And if Romney's keeping things close in the state, I think Thompson probably wins. But the other candidates, you know, most of the polls have shown very close polling between Newman and Baldwin. either Newman up a handful of points or tied races, which I think is about accurate at this point. Hovde is not very well known statewide at all, but it'll be interesting to see how that plays. My sense is that if it's Thompson as the nominee, it's going to be pretty tough for Tammy Baldwin. It's not a slam dunk for Thompson. It's going to be, it's a very quick campaign when you're looking at 6 weeks and you're trying to buy airtime and get attention when a presidential race is going on. It's very difficult. And it looks like, Wisconsin is going to be on the target list for both campaigns, although I don't know if it'll be high on the target list for Romney. So it's going to be very interesting. I mean, if the presidential race really heats up there, I think that benefits the Republicans, because my sense is especially Thompson will run a little bit ahead of Romney. If this ends up being kind of an isolated race where the Senate race really is the marquee battleground, it could be a little bit better for the Democrats. But, I've talked to a lot of Democratic activists in the state who had a serious letdown after the gubernatorial race. They still haven't really tuned into the Senate race. They're some of them are excited about Obama, but some of them are kind of upset that he didn't do more for the governor's race. And so it could be kind of an interesting dynamic to see how the liberal activists in the state react. They do love Baldwin, and I think they'll be coming out for her. But, there was such an emotional letdown after what happened when Walker won,
right,
with a fairly substantial numbers, that it's going to be interesting to see how they bounce back from that.
Mm-hmm. Betty in Milwaukee, our first caller for this. Hi, Betty.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Well, let's face it, big money's going to win the race. They're going to buy their... The Republicans will buy their way, and I often wonder where the 97% of the people that are not in that 1% and 2%, where they are. Why aren't they out there voting for someone that would be on their side of the fence? And that's all I have to say.
All right, Betty. Thank you. Cameron.
Well, I think it's true that the Republicans are going to be able to outspend the Democrats with these outside group money, and they've already been doing that. There have been some ads in the state attacking Baldwin that are coming from outside groups, and it'll be really interesting to see. I think American Crossroads Crossroads GPS are pretty committed to the Wisconsin race. They're big spending group backed by Karl Rove and a few other top Republicans who have been helping a lot. Haley Barbour as well has been helping a lot with fundraising for them. And what they're able to do is really expand the Senate playing field into places like Wisconsin, some other states that look like they could be on the verge of being competitive for the Republicans. They're competitive, but they're not toss-ups yet, in like New Mexico, places like that. And what they can do is soften up the Democrats when there are these crowded primaries. It's also happening in Missouri, where the Republicans haven't picked their nominee yet. But rather than kind of having to wait and let Baldwin just gather money, they're forcing her to spend. She had to go up with another ad today. And I think that really helps them, because it forces her to go up a little earlier than she would normally. And it gives the Republicans a little more parity when they come out of this primary and a little more time to catch up, rather than just being knocked flat, having spent a lot, and come out with a competitive primary and then having her just waiting for them immediately. And so these outside groups are definitely going to play a big role, not just in the primary, but also in the general election. I think that definitely benefits the Republicans.
Isn't it absolutely astounding, Cameron, how much money is involved in all of these races now? Toledo.
It's pretty shocking to me. I mean, what used to look like gigantic buys, especially this early, I'm not even writing up sometimes when you're coming out with a million-dollar ad buy in some of these states. It's all of a sudden just a run-of-the-mill week-to-week buy. And you see, the candidates themselves are raising more money than they have in the past. B, these outside groups are able to just really dump a ton of money into a lot of these races. This could be, once we combine the presidential and the Senate races, we could be looking at the first billion-dollar election. And it really, when you start spreading that out, we're talking about, in a lot of states, maybe not Wisconsin, but in a lot of these competitive states, airtime is going to be booked up. You're literally going to be out of commercials you can buy a couple of weeks ahead of the election. You're going to be seeing nothing but ads. And I think you already experienced that in the state with
yes,
gubernatorial recall. And I think it's not going to let up. I think probably in about 2 to 3 weeks, we're going to already see the Republican ads coming in full force probably in the next week or two. And then immediately after that, we're just going to see a deluge of ads, both from the outside groups and the campaigns, that are really just going to lock up all of the airwaves from now until Election Day. But when you're seeing that much and you're talking about that level of saturation, it's kind of diminishing returns all of a sudden, unless it's a really biting message. The message isn't cutting through.
I agree. People tune it out. Yeah, another message. Quickly,
yeah, I mean, you saw all the money that was spent on the gubernatorial race, and it basically didn't move the numbers in the polls more than 1 or 2% for the entire last month of the election.
Can we do this next call in 30 seconds? Jenny from Delafield. Jenny?
Yes, hi. I have a question about the ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. Tommy Thompson has been a member in the past, and I was wondering how you think that affects legislation that's brought back to the state.
All right, quickly, please, Cameron.
Well, I mean, Thompson's going to be in the Senate. He won't be governor. ALEC has been a pretty important and influential group in terms of pushing through state legislation. They've kind of gotten some PR blowback, and some of the main corporate sponsors of the group are backing out a little bit. And that was definitely important for Scott Walker. He definitely took a few of his cues from them. A couple of his ideas were their ideas first. But I don't know how much that's going to play in the Senate race.
Thanks, Jenny, for the call. Cameron, thank you. Please join us again. We got a lot going on in the state. Thank you.
I appreciate it.
And I appreciate your analysis. Cameron Joseph, staff writer at The Hill, our guest. Thanks to Brett Jaspers for producing this lively and informative hour. And thanks to Brett as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Stay with us for hour number two. We're going to learn about an incredible scientific announcement last week. So don't go away. This is the Ideas Network.